Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Local Food Connections, a show about the power of locally grown food to connect us more strongly with our communities and the lands we inhabit. The show also goes wider than that, as you know, and promotes sustainable food systems that foster community resilience and empower individuals to make positive choices for themselves, their communities, and the environment. Local Food Connections is brought to you by Local Food Connect. We're broadcasting from Wurundjeri country and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. We respect the enduring strength of First Nations people and acknowledge their long heritage of agriculture and care for the land in which our food is grown. I'm joined today by Alex Decker.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. Alex is the founder of Alex Makes Meals. This is a food relief enterprise based on the principle that access to quality food is a human right, essential not only to nutrition but to dignity. So, using fresh quality ingredients, Alex Makes Meals prepares nutritional food in professional kitchens for distribution to community members in need. So welcome again, Alex.
Oh, thank you.
And would you just tell us the story of the generation? How did this all start?
Yeah. So firstly, great to be here. Alex Makes Meals is, we're just over 6 years old now. So we started back in 2020. In late February, which you will remember was a pretty bad time. Most people try not to remember it and, you know, didn't do a whole lot of things to form memories of. But I was a bored university student studying science at Monash at the time. And obviously I felt powerless. Everyone did. And feeling powerless is a terrible, terrible feeling. My sister, however, was anything but powerless because she was a doctor. Volunteered by her boss onto the first COVID ward. And that meant, given the way that we treat doctors and doctors treat themselves, she was working these 16-hour shifts, you know, getting to work a couple hours before the curfew started. Remember curfews? before the curfew started and getting home a couple hours after and then maybe getting 3 or 4 hours sleep and then doing that all over again 16 days in a row. It was quite terrible. And watching her go through that as a family member, as any of us would do, I'm like, oh, well, how can I help? So I, living within 5 kilometres of her, offered to cook her some food, put in some Tupperware, drop it at her door, chuck it in her fridge, and then walk back home. But I didn't really want to give her 16 servings of the same lasagna. That just seems a bit lazy. So I put out a call on Facebook saying, hey, look, I'm cooking right now. I need something to do. If you need food, if you're struggling, hit me up, let me know. A lot of people are in a dire straits. They won't ask questions. I'll just drop it at your house.
Well, you were just going to cook for an unlimited number of people.
Well, you know, it was my private Facebook. I thought I'd get like 5-6 people. but you've picked up on the fundamental mistake.
Fundamental flaw in the plan.
Idiot 19-year-old brain had not figured out. So that evening, 400 people asked me for food, which is so much more than a 19-year-old should be able to cook for.
And did you have any idea about who these people were?
Absolutely nothing. So,
okay.
I didn't really. I had Facebook settings just set to just, if you want to view it, sure. Which is fine, because it only gets shown to your friends. But then a couple of my friends shared it in some groups.
Aha, uh-huh, that's what happened.
And those groups went viral, and then we went viral in those ways that things did back then.
Because everyone's sitting at home.
Yeah. So I started GoFundMe to raise $100, and then it raised about $3,000 overnight. And I thought, oh, damn, that's a lot of money. And so every single person that was asking for food was paired or met with 2 or 3 people offering help. A lot of these offers were kind of useless. People going, oh, I've got some expiring bananas. Do you want to pick them up from my house? You know, I live 4 hours away and you'll have to drive. Less useful for me. But then we had a couple more interesting ones, such as, hey, we're a Wagyu steak provider and we've just cancelled the Formula One. Do you want $70,000 worth of meat? Which, by the way, sure, Wagyu steaks, incredible. but then we had a really interesting one from a restaurant called The Hardware Club up in Flinders Lane. In Hardware Lane, obviously. And they said, hey, we just opened our restaurant about 2 months before COVID started. We don't want to shut it down, and half of our staff are here on sponsored visas. Do you want our entire restaurant and staff? So all of a sudden I went from terrible dorm room kitchen to restaurant, like Michelin star quality restaurant with staff.
Just hang on. What do you mean dorm room? You're doing this out of Monash Uni Halls of Residence?
No, I was in a terrible share house right next door. I didn't have the money for Halls of Residence. I'll go.
All right, that's amazing. I just wanted, this is a little bit of a sidetrack, but this is the thing about COVID. I was really amazed and excited by the way people pivoted. Mm-hmm. It was such a time of opportunity. The crisis just gave rise to such opportunity.
Yeah, so there's a book on this by one of my favorite authors called Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit. She's incredible. Mostly does like these strange anthropological poetry books, but this book is a pretty hard look at all the stats figures about crisis response.
Can you tell me the surname of
Solnit? Solnit.
Okay.
And it's really kind of flips on its head the understanding that, you know, crowds panic and need to be controlled during crisis.
Yeah, not yes.
Which
that's
is
right.
It's a totally untrue. You know, yeah, there's never been a panicked flash mob in the event of general crisis. Sure, in a tidal wave coming up, people will run. But, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're dropping bombs on them.
Aren't going to enjoy that. Yeah. Yeah. People have nowhere to go. But even in the circumstance of dropping bombs, what really happens is leadership shows up within the community.
That's
they self-organize.
And all the skills that are in that community.
Exactly.
Are
and
used.
They self-mobilize. And it is so much more effective to allow that to happen and to facilitate that happening instead of coming down and, you know, doing some kind of top-down level management.
Totally.
Which is a sidetrack, but it meant that in a crisis like COVID, we had so many incredible both businesses starting up, charities starting up, and also just general movements. There was a wonderful organization. A friend, I think, knitted about 2,000 face masks. Sewed 2,000 face masks. I have a friend who started a restaurant back then by doing home pasta that spiraled into what is now Al Dente, which is an incredible restaurant down the road from this studio, actually. So it's in crisis like that, you have some really cool things popping up. One of them being us. Yeah. So it's called Alex Makes Meals because it was originally Alex making meals in a dorm room. And the reason, like, I started the page because I'm like, oh, well, I obviously have to get this off my personal Facebook. So I just quickly whip up a Facebook page so people message that instead of that because I still want to be able to message my friends. So they messaged the page. I drew in paint.net the little logo of Alex Makes Meals. And if you look at our logo today, we've had a professional designer, you know, zhuzh it up a bit. But you can still tell it's kind of like the basis was paint.net.
And did you take up the offer of that hardware?
Absolutely, I did. So I think we were there for 4 or 5 months. So a week later, after that first post, we made about 800 meals in a day, which felt like a huge achievement.
So you got chefs there.
We had chefs there. Yeah, we had volunteers. We still hadn't moved into the hardware club at that stage. So we hired / borrowed a kitchen in Mordialloc. Not Mordialloc, in Moorabbin. Which was, you know, probably too big for our needs. And then the day after our first cook day, we moved up to the Hardware Club and started making about 600 meals a day out of there every day.
And who's paying those workers?
So a lot of them were on JobKeeper.
Oh, I forgot about that too.
JobKeeper, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So also you had everyone in HOSPO essentially being paid to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
HOSPO people are not good at staying at home.
Mm-hmm.
They're not... If you've ever met or seen a kitchen. These are not people who are... it's not healthy for them to sit still. It's
very
bad for
fast-paced,
us, them, and probably the entirety of society if we keep them, you know, tell them to calm down. So all of these people are kind of desperate to be in a kitchen. So volunteers at the time were incredibly easy to come by. And because of the Hardware Club's incredible network, our volunteers also tended to come from chef hat level restaurants. So I think at one time we had 11 chef hats in the restaurant, which was, as someone who before this was a dish pig, right? Like I was paying my way for university, washing dishes in one of the most terrible clubs you've ever seen. It was quite the, I guess, apprenticeship to work under all of these incredible fine dining chefs day in, day out, work alongside them. I to this day regret not spending more time in that kitchen because, you know, it was an incredible experience.
Sometimes those jobs are really important, aren't they, in ways that you don't realise?
Absolutely, yeah. But, you know, someone had to do the paperwork. And my God, in starting a charity, I can tell you, as a lot of listeners, I'm sure, are, you know, aligned to the social good space, there's a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
The admin side of things is very heavy. But that's a, you know, me problem.
Well, let's just jump now then to the size of the operation in that case. So can you just give us a bit of an idea of, you know, where the money comes from? Are you getting grants? How many people are you feeding? And how many people have you got working?
So I think we have about 7 or 8 staff at the moment working, been a mix of part full-time and casual. We're feeding close to 4,500 people a week today, and in terms of where the funding comes from, it's a pretty split mix between, you know, public donors from the general public, people who listen to the show, that kind of thing, and grants and philanthropy. So we just won a state government grant to expand up all the way between Melbourne and Shepparton, so that's a $300,000 grant in partnership to do the Northeast Growth Corridor for a year. Which we are hoping gets continued next year, but that's a whole thing. But it's from the charity's perspective, we're in a pretty fortunate time because food relief is such a hot topic. Because price of groceries is, you know, skyrocketing. You're seeing it at the checkout that food is getting more expensive, and all the news about urea shortages and fertilizer going down, that kind of stuff. That's all putting it at the front of mind. Which means at the moment we have this good amount of momentum to be able to, like, actually start looking at expanding. The problem is, the situation at the moment is not hugely worse than it was 12 months ago. It was just hidden back then.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because we've had now 5 years of pretty consistent crisis in this country. Some of it our fault, some of it not. You know, no one could predict or stop COVID. And similarly, I don't think even the most cynical political commentators would call Australia to blame for the Iran war. And that stoppage at the moment has really... It's made a lot of people think about where their food comes from, and it's made a lot of people think about where the resources they use come from, mostly because everything they're buying is twice as expensive as it used to be. But when you actually look at it, the price of food is not really driving food insecurity in Australia, because we have so much food, and compared to other countries and compared to average incomes, food is incredibly cheap in Australia. We're spending, I think it's about 9.5% of our weekly budget on food per person.
Oh, that's interesting. 9.5?
Yeah, about 9.5, which is one of the lowest in the world. I think only America and the UK and Canada go below it. So America's at about 6%. And that means, you know, if food prices go up 50%, that becomes, instead of 9%, that goes to like 14%, which is not a huge change on... on your weekly budget.
That's the average wage earner, though, isn't it?
That's the average household.
That's someone who's got income coming in.
100%. But the problem is, the reason why, you know, the food prices aren't the drivers is because in Australia we have such huge fuel expenses and such huge rental expenses.
And trucks,
And so you, on the whole, lower income earners tend to have to travel more by car, which is huge, but also rent is so high in this country compared to anywhere else. Like, it is one of the most expensive, as a proportion of your income, countries to live in a house anywhere. And people can't not live in a house, obviously. Like, that is going to be the last thing that goes when you're looking at food security. So, sure, it might only be cutting that 9% if you stop buying food. But they don't really have anything left to cut. You can't not pay bills. You can't not drive to work. You can't not live in a house. So food is, while it's small, it is the only thing they can cut. But it also means that if they're starting to substitute out food and they're starting to access services like ours, there's only so much good it does their weekly budget, and they still find themselves in the hole at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's a really great, really good insight to give, actually. So it's about the price of housing.
It's about the price of housing, and like fuel has tipped things over the edge. Like, the increased interest rates over the last couple of years has, of course, driven up the price of housing, and we are starting to see that in increases in prices of rentals, particularly post-COVID. The rentals was going up, you know, 7% a year for a while. And, like, that is abnormal. it's also something that the individual has no power to change. So, like, there is... No matter how much you might believe in pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, X, Y, Z, an individual on the street, like you and I walking down the street, we can't really change how much we're paying for rent. We can't just move to a cheaper property.
Provided we want to have shelter.
Because we need shelter, right? And everyone's competing for a finite pool at the moment.
Yeah.
And that is the driver, but it's also a much harder policy one to change.
Yeah.
Which is where we come in having to kind of be the band-aid to this crisis. Because
So how many, the people who are accessing your service, who are they?
Yeah, it's, we can say it's a pretty diverse lot. So we have about 50 distribution points across the state. Each of those can be anywhere from, you know, some direct homeless and street side centres to, you know, mums and women's groups, to family and drug and alcohol rehab programs, youth programs. We serve anyone and everyone who needs food relief. And one of the only conditions we have is it's not means tested. You don't walk in there get checked for a healthcare card.
Yeah, yeah.
Because so many people don't fit that requirement. There's so many people who are here as international students.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just getting, you know, hugely overexpensed. And their agents back home were probably not telling them how expensive it is to live here.
Mm.
Or their parents are potentially, you know, run out of money. Or they just haven't known how to buy food at the supermarket because at their home countries, they only ever bought food from street-side vendors for very little.
Uh-huh.
Whereas you, obviously, if you eat out in Australia, that's a very high expense thanks to the cost of labour, which is, you know, suitably high because we have to pay people to cook, obviously.
Yeah.
But it just means that the dynamics of eating in Australia are pretty unique as well.
Yeah, interesting.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same.
I'm sick of the little boxes. Aren't you too? Do you want to live in nourishing, green neighbourhoods where we share and care for one another and our precious planet? Are you sick of greedy people gatekeeping better futures from the rest of us? Then listen to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence every fortnight on a Friday at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR with myself, Amy, and the wonderful people taking back their cities.
And they all look just the same.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
This is the Local Food Connection Show on 3CR 855 kHz on your AM radio dial and 3CR on digital radio. You can also visit the 3CR website and listen to the live streaming of the show, and you can go and listen to all of our podcasts if you go to 3CR Local Food Connections. I'm chatting with Alex Decker about his organisation Alex Makes Meals, which is serving meals to approximately 4,500 people a week, and at 50 different distribution centres with 7 or 8 paid staff.
Yeah.
Not 78.
No, it's not quite 78. That would be a much bigger organisation.
Right. Now, talking about the size of the organisation, I imagine you're the person running it. This must be a constant issue. Have you had to employ people to organise the
distribution, the logistics. It's
the logistics and also the fundraising.
Yeah, so we're currently hiring a fundraiser, and we've got one at the moment as well. She's a wonderful woman named Steph, who I think was a you were talking to when organizing this shoot, this recording. So with any charity, it's pretty unavoidable that there are overheads. There's a pretty pernicious viewpoint out there sometimes that charities waste money on overheads. But the unfortunate matter is, in order for us to do our job well, we have our COO, name's Jen. She's a wonderful, incredibly talented woman who's organizing where all the food goes to. But we also need people to make sure the money comes in. So we need a fundraiser to make sure that happens. Because when you're serving as many meals a week as we are, and we have, you know, those 50 sites that are serving our meals, they're using our meals as the basis of their food relief program. And these distribution sites, they're not doing it really for food relief. Food relief is the platform they're using to do what their actual mission is. So if their mission is, you know, supporting mothers, what they'll be doing is they'll be going using these lovely community lunches or community dinners to bring mothers in, create a safe place, build up that relationship.
I see, yep.
And because, as we identified, like, food is the first and also last thing to go in the budget, in that you can't not pay for rent, you can't not pay for bills. So when people start exhibiting meal-seeking behavior, when they start trying to find a free meal, that's the start of them hitting real financial strife.
Yeah, and before that, they've done things like got cheaper bread, supermarket, or skipped a meal, or whatever.
They've done the kind of budgeting you and I do on a daily basis, you know, and God forbid we fall into that, but we might at some point into that kind of level of need. But when people start seeking out free food, it's the first time and also most effective time to create an intervention. And that intervention can only be done if that person trusts the sites and that site is an expert. So our distribution sites tend to have social workers in or experts in the site. They're run by other organizations, to be clear. We work with specialist place-based organizations to do this.
Is that a deliberate decision or is it just it is?
Right? It is. It's both a deliberate decision and also a recognition of the fact that given how many meals we serve, it would be kind of a nightmare to have to give that to individuals at that scale.
And have volunteers doing it on haphazard.
Terrifying, right?
But I need to point out also that you're not rescuing food, you're buying good quality, fresh produce.
Yeah, so we don't do food rescue in the way that a lot of other food organizations might. Not because it's not an important thing, but because of the kind of service we do, we focus on having that food of high quality that brings people back week on week on week. We're able to plan out and say, we are, in 6 weeks' time, we're doing this meal. In 7 weeks' time, we're doing this meal. And we're able to ensure the quality is always constant and people know what they're getting. Mm-hmm. So that when they're trying to build up these trusting relationships with these frontline sites, they know every time that meal is going to be good, it's going to have healthy, fresh ingredients in. And it really just both simplifies our kitchen process, but also ensures that we're able to give the kind of meals that you and I would have. Mm-hmm. Because we don't want, you know, us to be giving them just anything because, you know, oh, they're getting it for free, so why should it?
Yeah, why should they have a choice? Or why should they have a preference in what they want to eat?
Exactly. We want them to want our food because that food keeps, if they want our food, they're going to keep seeking it out. Yeah. And when they keep seeking it out, they're going to build up that relationship with the social workers, build up that trust. That social worker can kind of go, oh, Sarah, you've got a nasty bump. Have you had that looked at? Or, oh, where are you sleeping tonight? That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And actually build up those connections and refer them to services that can help them and potentially get them out of the situation that is forcing them to seek food in the first place. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we were just kind of scattershot doing it whenever someone made a donation and like going, oh, we got donated $600 this week, we're going to make 450 meals, something like that. Mm. Then we wouldn't be able to build up those trusting relationships with clients, which goes back to why we have those overheads. It's because when you're doing food relief like we are, it's so important to be reliable and consistent. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to be reliably good and reliably consistent.
Which is part of the dignity, is this, but it's part of giving people hospitality.
Absolutely. And then it also means that we're able to use that meal to do so many further flow-on effects. Mm-hmm. And sure, it might cost us, you know, at the moment, I think it's about $1.10 per meal. Thanks to rising food costs, up until very recently, we were hitting under a dollar.
Wow.
So it's about $1.10 per meal, thanks to also farmside supply deals we have and some bulk purchase contracts that we've been very lucky to be able to negotiate and grateful for from our suppliers, we're able to do the kind of food that you and I would cook at home for very little. Mm. But then it's able to both save the person at the site the $10 it would make for you to buy those ingredients and cook it yourself if you were going to Woolworths or something like that. It saves them $10, but then it also connects them to a incalculable value multiplier at the service. Some in Scandinavia, there's been some studies done trying to kind of put a number on what is the value of a person coming into a community organization? What is the value of them talking to a social worker?
Yep.
You're generally looking at about 50-1
right.
return on investment.
Right.
Just in terms of the savings to the health system, the long-term savings, and like this person will re-enter the workforce, they'll stop having to rely on these services. Like, it is a pretty incredible return on investment.
And their mental health will be
absolutely
helped by being part of a community.
And this is, yeah, before you even think about the actual human level of it, it is just a good thing to do when these people appreciate the help and need it.
Yep.
You know? Like, but we can only do that when we are consistent and good.
Okay, so Alex, can you give us a sense of what your operational costs are? Like, what
Yeah, so it's at the moment our operational costs, they're broken down. There's, of course, the overheads in terms of like the COO, myself, the fundraiser, the stuff required to make the organization wake up in the morning. And then we've got the kitchen rental, we've got the food costs, we've got the chef costs, because in the kitchen we have volunteers, but they're all run by the head chef. Heather's an incredible woman, kind of a culinary genius, and very good at budgeting for meals. So she's a cost that we have to incur every day in there. So all around, the organization costs about just under $1 million a year to run. And that's largely driven by growth over the last 2 years. So we were costing about $300,000 a year to run up until 2 years ago when things really started to...
Goodness. You've gone from $300,000 to $1 million.
About $1 million at the moment, yeah. Well, that'll be at the end of this financial, it'll be. I think last year was about $500,000.
Okay.
And so it's going up because both there is an increased interest in food relief, but also there's a huge increase in demand. But that, to reiterate on my first point, that demand's not new. That is the last 2 years we've really started reaching crisis point. COVID, believe it or not, poverty actually went down in Australia.
Yep.
It was for the most vulnerable in Australia. That was one of the best things that's ever happened because the immediate doubling of JobSeeker meant, and the removal of the reporting requirements for, like, you have to apply for 20 jobs a week or whatever the number is. That took so many people out of food crisis and so many people out of crisis by just giving them, you know, the poverty line level of income. But since then, since obviously that's been rolled back because it was incredibly expensive and not a popular policy for the general public. And the war in Iran, interest rates making up for the spend of COVID, all that stuff, that started to create an actual crisis. It's not grocery prices aren't driving it. It is the years of consistent crisis. I mean, no one has a spongy bank account left, that we don't have savings we can dig into.
Okay. How much money do you raise from individual donations? Like, if
you've got
a fundraiser coming up, right?
Can you we've got a fundraiser coming up. So we have, once a year, we host a wonderful little gala. This time it's at the National Gallery of Victoria at the NGV. It's called Feast to Feed. If you look it up, any of your listeners, look it up. And that, we have some of the best chefs in Melbourne. So we've got Matt Preston, we've got Gary Mayagan, we've got Nat Typhoon, we've got Andrea Vignale, hosted by Sophia Levin. Tickets to that are $275. It's going to raise us about probably just under $200,000. But then other than that, every year about $250,000 to $300,000 come from regular public donations. And that is the stuff we use to go directly into the meals. So that's paying for the ingredients.
Sadly, we've run out of time, and I just want to say congratulations, Alex. I don't want to say that says it's congratulations. What an amazing achievement. You can go to the website and find out a way to send in individual donations if you like, or you can go to the fundraiser. You've been listening to Local Food Connections on 3CR. We've been speaking to Alex Decker from Alex Makes Meals. Until next week, love the land you're on. Share your surplus. Take care of each other. If you value independent media, please donate or become a 3CR subscriber. And stay tuned now for more Radical Radio with Latin American Update. Bye for now.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.